361 feet, and Everest's 26,748-foot neighbor, Cho Oyu. Later still, I encountered a member of Mal Duff's commercial expedition, a 28-year-old Finn named Veikka Gustafsson, whose record of previous Himalayan ascents included Everest, Dalagiri, Makalu, and Lhotse. No client on Hall's team, by comparison, had ever reached the summit of any 8,000-meter peak. If someone like Pete Schoening was the equivalent of a Major League Baseball star, my fellow clients and I were like a ragtag collection of pretty decent small-town softball players who'd bribed their way into the World Series. Yes, at the top of the icefall, Hall had called us a good strong bunch. And we actually were strong, perhaps, relative to groups of clients Hall had ushered up the mountain in past years. It was clear to me, nevertheless, that none of us in Hall's group had a prayer of climbing Everest without considerable assistance from Hall, his guides, and his Sherpas. On the other hand, our group was far more competent than a number of the other teams on the mountain. There were some climbers of very dubious ability on a commercial expedition led by an Englishman with undistinguished Himalayan credentials. But the least qualified people on Everest were not in fact guided clients at all. Rather, they were members of traditionally structured non-commercial expeditions. As I was heading back to base camp through the lower icefall, I overtook a pair of slower climbers outfitted with very strange-looking clothing and equipment. It was apparent almost immediately that they weren't very familiar with the standard tools and techniques of glacier travel. The climber in back repeatedly snagged his crampons and stumbled. Waiting for them to cross a yawning crevasse bridged by two rickety ladders spliced end to end, I was shocked to see them go across together, almost in lockstep, a needlessly dangerous act. An awkward attempt at conversation on the far side of the crevasse revealed that they were members of a Taiwanese expedition. The reputations of the Taiwanese preceded them to Everest. In the spring of 1995, the same team had traveled to Alaska to climb Mount McKinley as a shakedown for the attempt on Everest in 1996. 9 climbers reached the summit, but 7 of them were caught by a storm on the descent, became disoriented, and spent a night in the open at 19,400 feet, initiating a costly, hazardous rescue by the National Park Service. Responding to a request by park rangers, Alex Lowe and Conrad Anker, two of the most skilled alpinists in the United States, interrupted their own ascent and rushed up from 14,400 feet to aid the Taiwanese climbers, who were by then barely alive. With great difficulty and considerable risk to their own lives, Lowe and Anker each dragged a helpless Taiwanese from 19,400 feet down to 17,200 feet, at which point a helicopter was able to evacuate them from the mountain. All told, 5 members of the Taiwanese team, 2 with severe frostbite and 1 already dead, were plucked from McKinley by chopper. "Only 1 guy died," says Anker, "but if Alex and I hadn't arrived right when we did, 2 others would have died too. Earlier we'd noticed the Taiwanese group because they looked so incompetent. It wasn't any big surprise when they got into trouble." The leader of the expedition, Gao Ming Ho, a jovial freelance photographer who calls himself Makalu after the striking Himalayan peak of that name, was exhausted and frostbitten and had to be assisted down the upper mountain by a pair of Alaskan guides. "As the Alaskans brought him down," Anker reports, "Makalu was yelling, 'Victory! Victory! We made summit!' to everyone they passed, as if the disaster hadn't even happened. Yeah, that Makalu dude struck me as pretty weird." When the survivors of the McKinley debacle showed up on the south side of Everest in 1996, Makalu Gao was again their leader. The presence of the Taiwanese on Everest was a matter of grave concern to most of the other expeditions on the mountain. There was a very real fear that the Taiwanese would suffer a calamity that would compel other expeditions to come to their aid, risking further lives, to say nothing of jeopardizing the opportunity for other climbers to reach the summit. But the Taiwanese were by no means the only group that seemed egregiously unqualified. Camped beside us at base camp was a 25-year-old Norwegian climber named Peter Naby, who announced his intention to make a solo ascent of the southwest face, one of the peak's most dangerous and technically demanding routes, despite the fact that his Himalayan experience was limited to two ascents of neighboring Island Peak, a 20,274-foot bump on a subsidiary ridge of Lhotse, involving nothing more technical than vigorous walking. Note: although Nebi's expedition was billed as a solo endeavor, he had employed 18 Sherpas to carry his loads, fix ropes for him, establish his camps, and guide him up the mountain. End of note. And then there were the South Africans. Sponsored by a major newspaper, the Johannesburg Sunday Times, their team had inspired effusive national pride and had received a personal blessing from President Nelson Mandela prior to their departure. They were the first South African expedition ever to be granted a permit to climb Everest, a mixed-race group that aspired to put the first black person on the summit. Their leader was Ian Woodall, 39, a loquacious, mouse-like man who relished telling anecdotes about his brave exploits as a military commando behind enemy lines during South Africa's long, brutal conflict with Angola in the 1980s. Woodall had recruited three of South Africa's strongest climbers to form the nucleus of his team: Andy de Klerk, Andy Hackland, and Edmund February. The biracial makeup of the team was of special significance to February, 40, a soft-spoken black paleoecologist and a climber of international renown. "My parents named me after Sir Edmund Hillary," he explains. "Climbing Everest had been a personal dream of mine ever since I was very young. But even more significantly, I saw the expedition as a powerful symbol of a young nation trying to unify itself and move towards democracy, trying to recover from its past. I grew up with the yoke of apartheid around my neck in many ways, and I am extremely bitter about that. But we are a new nation now. I firmly believe in the direction my country's taking. To show that we in South Africa could climb Everest together, black and white on the top, that would be a great thing." The entire nation rallied behind the expedition.
"Woodall proposed the project at a really fortuitous time," says de Klerk. "With the end of apartheid, South Africans were finally allowed to travel wherever they wanted, and our sports teams could compete around the world. South Africa had just won the Rugby World Cup. There was this national euphoria, a great upwelling of pride, yeah? So when Woodall came along and proposed a South African Everest expedition, everybody was in favor of it, and he was able to raise a lot of money, the equivalent of several hundred thousand dollars in U.S. currency, without anybody asking a lot of questions."
In addition to himself, the three male climbers and a British climber and photographer named Bruce Harrod, Woodall wanted to include a woman on the expedition. So prior to leaving South Africa, he invited six female candidates on a physically grueling but technically undemanding ascent of 19,340-foot Kilimanjaro. At the conclusion of the two-week trial, Woodall announced that he'd narrowed the field down to two finalists: Kathy O'Dowd, 26, a white journalism instructor with limited mountaineering experience whose father is the director of Anglo-American, the largest company in South Africa, and Dacian Desel, 25, a black physical education teacher with no previous climbing experience whatsoever, who'd grown up in a segregated township. Both women, said Woodall, would accompany the team to base camp, and he would choose one of them to continue up Everest after evaluating their performance during the trek. "On April 1st, during the second day of my journey to base camp, I was surprised to run into February, Hackland, and de Klerk on the trail below Namche Bazaar, walking out of the mountains, bound for Kathmandu. De Klerk, a friend of mine, informed me that the three South African climbers and Charlotte Noble, their team's doctor, had resigned from the expedition before even getting to the base of the mountain. Woodall, the leader, turned out to be a complete asshole," explained de Klerk. "A total control freak, and you couldn't trust him. We never knew if he was talking bullshit or telling the truth. We didn't want to put our lives in the hands of a guy like that, so we left." Woodall had made claims to de Klerk and others that he climbed extensively in the Himalaya, including ascents above 26,000 feet. In fact, the whole of Woodall's Himalayan mountaineering experience consisted of reaching 21,300 feet as a paying client on a commercial expedition to Annapurna, led by Mal Duff in 1990. Additionally, Before leaving for Everest, Woodall had boasted on the expedition's internet website of a distinguished military career in which he'd risen through the ranks of the British Army to command the elite long-range mountain reconnaissance unit that did much of its training in the Himalayas. He told the Sunday Times that he had been an instructor at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst, England, as well. As it happens, there is no such thing as a long-range mountain reconnaissance unit in the British Army, and Woodall never served as an instructor at Sandhurst. Nor did he ever fight behind enemy lines in Angola. According to a spokesman for the British Army, Woodall served as a pay clerk. Woodall also lied about whom he'd listed on the Everest climbing permit issued by the Nepalese Ministry of Tourism. Note, only climbers listed on the official permit at a cost of $10,000 a head are allowed to ascend above base camp. This rule is strictly enforced, and violators face prohibitive fines and expulsion from Nepal. End of note. From the beginning, he'd said that both Kathy O'Dowd and Deshun Desel were on the permit, and that the final decision about which woman would be invited to join the climbing team would be made at base camp. After leaving the expedition, de Klerk discovered that O'Dowd was listed on the permit, as well as Woodall's 69-year-old father and a Frenchman named Thierry Renard, who'd paid Woodall $35,000 to join the South African team. But Deshun Desel, the only black member after the resignation of Ed February, was not. This suggested to de Klerk that Woodall had never had any intention of letting Desel climb the mountain. Adding insult to injury, before leaving South Africa, Woodall had cautioned de Klerk, who was married to an American woman and has dual citizenship, that he would not be allowed on the expedition unless he agreed to use his South African passport to enter Nepal. "He made a big fuss about it," recalls de Klerk, "because we were the first South African Everest expedition and all that. But it turns out that Woodall doesn't hold a South African passport himself. He's not even a South African citizen. The guy's a Brit, and he entered Nepal on his British passport." Woodall's numerous deceits became an international scandal, reported on the front pages of newspapers throughout the British Commonwealth. As the negative press filtered back to him, the megalomaniacal leader turned a cold shoulder to the criticism and insulated his team as much as possible from the other expeditions. He also banished Sunday Times reporter Ken Vernon and photographer Richard Shorey from the expedition, even though Woodall had signed a contract stipulating that in return for receiving financial backing from the newspaper, the two journalists would be allowed to accompany the expedition at all times, and that failure to honor the stipulation would be cause for breach of contract. The editor of the Sunday Times, Ken Owen, was en route to base camp with his wife at the time, midway through a trekking vacation that had been arranged to coincide with the South African Everest expedition and was being led by Woodall's girlfriend, a young Frenchwoman named Alexandrine Godin. In Faroche, Owen learned that Woodall had given the boot to his reporter and photographer. Flabbergasted, he sent a note to the expedition leader explaining that the newspaper had no intention of pulling Vernon and Shorey from the story and that the journalists had been ordered to rejoin the expedition. When Woodall received this message, he flew into a rage and rushed down to Faroche from base camp to have it out with Owen. According to Owen, during the ensuing confrontation, he asked Woodall point-blank if Desel's name was on the permit. Woodall replied, "That's none of your business." When Owen suggested that Desel had been reduced to serving as a token black woman to give the team a spurious South Africanism, Woodall threatened to kill both Owen and his wife. At one point, the overwrought expedition leader declared, "I'm going to rip your fucking head off and ram it up your ass." Shortly thereafter, journalist Ken Vernon arrived at the South African base camp, an incident he first reported from Rob Hall's satellite fax machine, only to be informed by a grim-faced Miss O'Dowd that I was not welcome at the camp. As Vernon later wrote in the Sunday Times, "I told her she had no right to bar me from a camp my newspaper had paid for. When pressed further, she said she was acting on instructions from Mr. Woodall. She said Shorey had already been thrown out of the camp, and I should follow, as I would not be given food or shelter there. My legs were still shaky from the walk,
and before deciding whether to fight the edict or leave, I asked for a cup of tea.
No way, came the reply. Ms. O'Dowd walked to the team's Sherpa leader, Ang Dorji, and said audibly,
This is Ken Vernon, one of the ones we told you about. He is to be given no assistance whatsoever.
Ang Dorji is a tough, nuggety rock of a man, and we had already shared several glasses of Chang, the fiery local brew. I looked at him and said,
Not even a cup of tea?
To his credit, and in the best tradition of Sherpa hospitality, he looked at Ms. O'Dowd and said,
Bullshit!
He grabbed me by the arm, dragged me into the mess tent, and served up a mug of steaming tea and a plate of biscuits.
Following what Owen described as his blood-chilling exchange with Woodall and Faraday, the editor was persuaded that the atmosphere of the expedition was deranged, and that the Sunday Times staffers, Ken Vernon and Richard Shorey, might be in danger of their lives. Owen therefore instructed Vernon and Shorey to return to South Africa, and the newspaper published a statement declaring that it had rescinded its sponsorship of the expedition. Because Woodall had already received the newspaper's money, however, this act was purely symbolic and had almost no impact on his actions on the mountain. Indeed, Woodall refused to relinquish leadership of the expedition or make any kind of compromise, even after he received a letter from President Mandela appealing for reconciliation as a matter of national interest. Woodall stubbornly insisted that the Everest climb would proceed as planned, with him firmly at the helm. Back in Cape Town after the expedition fell apart, February described his disappointment.
Maybe I was naive, he said in a halting voice freighted with emotion, but I hated growing up under apartheid. Climbing Everest with Andrew and the others would have been a great symbol to show the old ways had broken down. Woodall had no interest in the birth of a new South Africa. He took the dreams of the entire nation and utilized them for his own selfish purposes. Deciding to leave the expedition was the hardest decision of my life. With the departure of February, Hackland, and de Klerk, none of the climbers remaining on the team, aside from the Frenchman, Renard, who had joined the expedition merely to be listed on the permit and who climbed independently from the others with his own Sherpas, had more than minimal alpine experience. At least two of them, says de Klerk, didn't even know how to put their crampons on. The solo Norwegian, the Taiwanese, and especially the South Africans were frequent topics of discussion in Hall's mess tent.
With so many incompetent people on the mountain, Rob said with a frown one evening in late April, I think it's pretty unlikely that we'll get through this season without something bad happening up high.
Chapter 8, Camp 1, April 16, 1996, 19,500 feet. I doubt if anyone would claim to enjoy life at high altitudes. Enjoy, that is, in the ordinary sense of the word. There is a certain grim satisfaction to be derived from struggling upwards, however slowly, but the bulk of one's time is necessarily spent in the extreme squalor of a high camp, when even this solace is lacking. Smoking is impossible. Eating tends to make one vomit. The necessity of reducing weight to a bare minimum forbids the importation of literature beyond that supplied by the labels on tins of food. Sardine oil, condensed milk, and treacle spill themselves all over the place, except for the briefest moments, during which one is not usually in a mood for aesthetic enjoyment. There is nothing to look at but the bleak confusion inside the tent and the scaly, bearded countenance of one's companion. Fortunately, the noise of the wind usually drowns out his stuffy breathing. Worst of all is the feeling of complete helplessness and inability to deal with any emergency that might arise. I used to try to console myself with the thought that a year ago I would have been thrilled by the very idea of taking part in our present adventure, a prospect that had then seemed like an impossible dream. But altitude has the same effect on the mind as upon the body. One's intellect becomes dull and unresponsive, and my only desire was to finish the wretched job and get down to a more reasonable climb. Eric Shipton, Upon That Mountain. Just before dawn on Tuesday, April 16th, After resting for 2 days at base camp, we headed up into the icefall to begin our second acclimatization excursion. As I nervously threaded my way through the frozen, groaning disorder, I noticed that my breathing wasn't quite as labored as it had been during our first trip up the glacier. Already my body was starting to adapt to the altitude. My dread of getting crushed by a falling serac, however, was at least as great as before. I had hoped that the giant overhanging tower at 19,000 feet, christened the Mousetrap by some wag on Fisher's team, had toppled by now, but it was still precariously upright, leaning even farther over. Again I redlined my cardiovascular output, rushing to ascend from its threatening shadow, and again dropped to my knees when I arrived on the serac's summit, gasping for air and trembling from the excess of adrenaline fizzing through my veins. Unlike our first acclimatization sally, during which we stayed at Camp 1 for less than an hour before returning to base camp, Rob intended for us to spend Tuesday and Wednesday nights at Camp 1 and then continue up to Camp 2 for 3 additional nights before heading down. At 9 a.m., when I reached the Camp 1 site, Ang Dorji, our climbing Sirdar, was excavating platforms for our tents in the hard frozen snow slope. Note: he should not be confused with the Sherpa on the South African team who has the same name. Ang Dorji, like Pemba, Lakpa, Ang Chering, Nawang, Dawa, Nima, and Pasang, is a very common Sherpa appellation. The fact that each of these names was shared by 2 or more Sherpas on Everest in 1996 was a source of occasional confusion. The Sirdar is the head Sherpa. Hall's team had a base camp Sirdar named Ang Chering, who was in charge of all the Sherpas employed by the expedition. Ang Dorji, the climbing Sirdar, answered to Ang Chering, but supervised the climbing Sherpas while they were on the mountain above base camp. End of note. 29 years old, he is a slender man with delicate features, a shy, moody temperament, and astounding physical strength. While waiting for my teammates to arrive, I picked up a spare shovel and started helping him dig. Within minutes, I was exhausted from the effort and had to sit down to rest, prompting a belly laugh from the Sherpa. "Are you not feeling good, John?" he mocked. "This is only Camp 1, 6,000 meters. The air here is still very thick." Ang Dorji hailed from Pangboche, an aggregation of stone-walled houses and terraced potato fields clinging to a rugged hillside at 13,000 feet. His father is a respected climbing Sherpa, who taught him the basics of mountaineering at an early age so that the boy would have marketable skills. By the time Ang Dorji was in his teens, his father had gone blind from cataracts, and Ang Dorji was pulled from school to earn money for the family. In 1984, he was working as a cook boy for a group of Western trekkers when he caught the attention of a Canadian couple, Marion Boyd and Graham Nelson. According to Boyd, "I was missing my kids, and as I grew to know Ang Dorji, he reminded me of my eldest son." Ang Dorji was bright, interested, keen to learn, and conscientious almost to a fault. He was carrying a huge load, and he had nosebleeds every day at high altitude. I was intrigued. After seeking the approval of Ang Dorji's mother, Boyd and Nelson started supporting the young Sherpa financially so that he could return to school. I will never forget his entry exam to gain admission to the regional primary school in Kumjung, built by Sir Edmund Hillary. He was very small in stature and prepubescent. We were crammed into a small room with the headmaster and 4 teachers. Ang Dorji stood in the middle with his knees quaking as he tried to resurrect the bit of formal learning he had for this oral exam. We all sweated blood, but he was accepted with the proviso that he would have to sit with the little kids in the first grades. Ang Dorji became an able student and achieved the equivalent of an 8th-grade education before quitting to go back to work in the mountaineering and trekking industry. Boyd and Nelson, who returned to the Khumbu several times, witnessed his maturation. "With access for the first time to a good diet, he began to grow tall and strong," recalls Boyd. "He told us with great excitement when he learned to swim in a pool in Kathmandu. At age 25 or so, he learned to ride a bicycle and took a brief fancy to the music of Madonna. We knew he was really grown up when he presented us with his first gift, a carefully selected Tibetan carpet. He wanted to be a giver, not a taker." As Ang Dorji's reputation for being a strong and resourceful climber spread among Western climbers, he was promoted to the role of Sirdar, and in 1992 he went to work for Rob Hall on Everest. By the launch of Hall's 1996 expedition, Ang Dorji had climbed the peak 3 times. With respect and obvious affection, Hall referred to him as "my main man," and mentioned several times that he considered Ang Dorji's role crucial to the success of our expedition. The sun was bright when the last of my teammates pulled into Camp 1, but by noon a scum of high cirrus had blown in from the south. By 3 o'clock, dense clouds swirled above the glacier, and snow pelted the tents with a furious clamor. It stormed through the night. In the morning, when I crawled out of the shelter I shared with Doug, more than a foot of fresh snow blanketed the glacier. Dozens of avalanches rumbled down the steep walls above, but our camp was safely beyond their reach. At first light on Thursday, April 18th, by which time the sky had cleared, we gathered our belongings and embarked for Camp 2, 4 miles and 1,700 vertical feet above. The route took us up the gently sloping floor of the Western Coombe, the highest box canyon on Earth, a horseshoe-shaped defile gouged from the heart of the Everest Massif by the Khumbu Glacier. The 25,790-foot ramparts of Nuptse defined the right wall of the Coombe. Everest's massive southwest face formed the left wall, and the broad, frozen thrust of the Lhotse face loomed above its head. The temperature had been brutally cold when we set out from Camp 1, turning my hands into stiff, aching claws, but as the first of the sun's rays struck the glacier, the ice-spackled walls of the Coombe collected and amplified the radiant heat like a huge solar oven. Suddenly I was sweltering, and I feared the onset of another migraine-intensity headache like the one that had hammered me at base camp, so I stripped down to my long underwear and stuffed a fistful of snow beneath my baseball cap. For the next 3 hours, I slogged steadily up the glacier, pausing only to drink from my water bottle and replenish the snow supply in my hat as it melted into my matted hair. At 21,000 feet, dizzy from the heat, I came upon a large object wrapped in blue plastic sheeting beside the trail. It took my altitude-impaired gray matter a minute or two to comprehend that the object was a human body. Shocked and disturbed, I stared at it for several minutes. That night when I asked Rob about it, he said he wasn't certain, but he thought the victim was a Sherpa who died 3 years earlier. At 21,300 feet, Camp 2 consisted of some 120 tents scattered across the bare rocks of the lateral moraine along the glacier's edge. The altitude here manifested itself as a malicious force, making me feel as though I were afflicted with a raging red wine hangover. Too miserable to eat or even read, for the next 2 days I mostly lay in my tent with my head in my hands, trying to exert myself as little as possible. Feeling slightly better on Saturday, I climbed 1,000 feet above camp to get some exercise and accelerate my acclimatization. And there, at the head of the Coombe, 50 yards off the main track, I came upon another body in the snow, or more accurately, the lower half of a body. The style of the clothing and the vintage leather boots suggested that the victim was European, and that the corpse had lain on the mountain at least 10 or 15 years. The first body had left me badly shaken for several hours. The shock of encountering the second wore off almost immediately. Few of the climbers trudging by had given either corpse more than a passing glance. It was as if there were an unspoken agreement on the mountain to pretend that these desiccated remains weren't real, as if none of us dared to acknowledge what was at stake here. On Monday, April 22nd, a day after returning from Camp 2 to base camp, Andy Harris and I hiked over to the South African compound to meet their team and to try to gain some insight into why they had become such pariahs. 15 minutes down the glacier from our tents, their camp was clustered atop a hump of glacial debris. The national flags of Nepal and South Africa, along with banners from Kodak, Apple Computer, and other sponsors, flew from a pair of tall aluminum flagpoles. Andy stuck his head inside the door of their mess tent, flashed his most winning smile, and inquired, "Hi there, is anybody home?" Andy stuck his head inside the door of their mess tent, flashed his most winning smile, and inquired, "Hi there, is anybody home?" It turned out that Ian Woodall, Kathy O'Dowd, and Bruce Harrod were in the icefall, making their way down from Camp 2. But Woodall's girlfriend, Alexandrine Godin, was present, as was his brother Philip. Also in the mess tent was an effervescent young woman who introduced herself as Dacian Dacel, and immediately invited Andy and me in for tea. The three teammates seemed unconcerned by the reports of Ian's reprehensible behavior and rumors predicting their expedition's imminent disintegration. "I went ice climbing for the first time the other day," Dacel offered enthusiastically, gesturing toward a nearby serac where climbers from several expeditions had been practicing their icecraft. "I thought it was quite exciting. I hope to go up the icefall in a few days." I'd intended to ask her about Ian's dishonesty and how she felt when she learned she'd been left off the Everest permit, but she was so cheerful and ingenuous that I didn't have the stomach for it. After chatting for 20 minutes, Andy extended an invitation to their whole team, including Ian, to come round our camp for a wee snort later that evening. I arrived back at our own camp to find Rob, Dr. Caroline McKenzie, and Scott Fisher's doctor, Ingrid Hunt, engaged in a tense radio conversation with someone higher on the mountain. Earlier in the day, Fisher was descending from Camp 2 to base camp when he encountered one of his Sherpas, Nawang Topche, sitting on the glacier at 21,000 feet. A veteran 38-year-old climber from the Rawaling Valley, gap-toothed and sweet-natured, Nawang had been hauling loads and performing other duties above base camp for 3 days, but his Sherpa cohorts complained that he had been sitting around a lot and not doing his share of the work. When Fisher questioned Nawang, he admitted that he'd been feeling weak, groggy, and short of breath for more than 2 days, so Fisher directed him to descend to base camp immediately. But there is an element of machismo in the Sherpa culture that makes many men extremely reluctant to acknowledge physical infirmities. Sherpas aren't supposed to get altitude illness, especially those from Rawaling, a region famous for its powerful climbers. Those who do become sick and openly acknowledge it, moreover, will often be blacklisted from future employment on expeditions. Thus it came to pass that Nawang ignored Scott's instructions and instead of going down, went up to Camp 2 to spend the night. By the time he arrived at the tents late that afternoon, Nawang was delirious, stumbling like a drunk, and coughing up pink, blood-laced froth, symptoms indicating an advanced case of high-altitude pulmonary edema, or HAPE, a mysterious, potentially lethal illness typically brought on by climbing too high, too fast, in which the lungs fill with fluid. Note: the root of the problem is believed to be a paucity of oxygen, compounded by high pressure in the pulmonary arteries, causing the arteries to leak fluid into the lungs. End of note. The only real cure for HAPE is rapid descent. If the victim remains at high altitude very long, death is the most likely outcome. Unlike Hall, who insisted that our group stay together while climbing above base camp, under the close watch of the guides, Fisher believed in giving his clients free rein to go up and down the mountain independently during the acclimatization period. As a consequence, when it was recognized that Nawang was seriously ill at Camp 2, 4 of Fisher's clients were present, Dale Cruz, Pete Schoening, Clev Schoening, and Tim Madsen, but no guides. Responsibility for initiating Nawang's rescue thus fell to Clev Schoening and Madsen, the latter a 33-year-old ski patrolman from Aspen, Colorado, who'd never been higher than 14,000 feet before this expedition, which he had been persuaded to join by his girlfriend, Himalayan veteran Charlotte Fox. When I walked into Hall's mess tent, Dr. McKenzie was on the radio telling somebody at Camp 2, "Give Nawang acetazolamide, dexamethasone, and 10 milligrams of sublingual nifedipine." "Yes, I know the risk. Give it to him anyway." "I'm telling you, the danger that he will die from HAPE before we can get him down is much, much greater than the danger that the nifedipine will reduce his blood pressure to a dangerous level. Please trust me on this. Just give him the medication, quickly." None of the drugs seemed to help, however, nor did giving Nawang supplemental oxygen or placing him inside a Gamow bag, an inflatable plastic chamber about the size of a coffin in which the atmospheric pressure is increased to simulate a lower altitude. With daylight waning, Schoening and Madsen therefore began dragging Nawang laboriously down the mountain, using the deflated Gamow bag as a makeshift toboggan, while guide Neil Beidelman and a team of Sherpas climbed as quickly as they could from base camp to meet them. Beidelman reached Nawang at sunset near the top of the icefall and took over the rescue, allowing Schoening and Madsen to return to Camp 2 to continue their acclimatization. The sick Sherpa had so much fluid in his lungs, Beidelman recalled, that when he breathed, it sounded like a straw slurping a milkshake from the bottom of a glass. Halfway down the icefall, Nawang took off his oxygen mask and he reached inside to clear some snot from the intake valve. When he pulled his hand out, I shined my headlamp on his glove, and it was totally red, soaked with blood he'd been coughing up into the mask. Then I shined the light on his face, and it was covered with blood, too. Nawang's eyes met mine, and I could see how frightened he was, Beidelman continued. Thinking fast, I lied and told him not to worry, that the blood was from a cut on his lip. That calmed him a little, and we continued down. To keep Nawang from having to exert himself, which would have exacerbated his edema, at several points during the descent, Beidelman picked up the ailing Sherpa and carried him on his back. It was after midnight by the time they arrived in base camp. The next morning, Tuesday, Fisher considered calling for a helicopter to evacuate Nawang from base camp to Kathmandu at an estimated cost of $5,000 to $10,000. But both Fisher and Dr. Hunt were confident that the Sherpa's condition would improve rapidly now that he was 3,700 feet lower than Camp 2. Descending as little as 3,000 feet is typically enough to bring about complete recovery from HAPE. The upshot was that instead of being evacuated by air, Nawang was escorted down the valley on foot. Immediately below base camp, however, he collapsed and had to be brought back up to the Mountain Madness encampment for treatment, where his condition continued to worsen throughout the day. When Hunt attempted to put him back in the Gamow bag, Nawang refused, arguing that he didn't have HAPE or any other form of altitude sickness. A radio call went out to the American doctor Jim Litch, an eminence in the specialized field of high-altitude medicine, who was staffing the Himalayan Rescue Association clinic in Faraceh that spring, requesting that he hurry to base camp to assist in Nawang's treatment. Fisher, by this time, had embarked for Camp 2 to bring down Tim Madsen, who had exhausted himself while hauling Nawang down the western coombe, and had subsequently come down with a mild case of HAPE himself. In Fisher's absence, Hunt consulted with the other doctors at base camp, but she was forced to make some critical decisions on her own. And, as one of her fellow physicians observed, Ingrid was in way over her head. A non-climber in her mid-twenties who'd just completed a residency in family practice, Hunt had done extensive volunteer medical relief work in the foothills of eastern Nepal, but she had no previous experience in high-altitude medicine. She'd met Fisher by chance some months earlier in Kathmandu when he was finalizing his Everest permit, and he subsequently invited her to accompany his upcoming Everest expedition in the dual roles of team physician and base camp manager. Although she expressed some ambivalence about the invitation in a letter to Fisher in January, Hunt ultimately accepted the unpaid job and arrived in Nepal at the end of March, eager to contribute to the expedition's success. The demands of simultaneously running base camp and meeting the medical needs of some 25 people proved to be more than she'd bargained for, however. By comparison, Rob Hall paid two highly experienced full-time staff members, team physician Caroline McKenzie and base camp manager Helen Wilton, to do what Hunt did alone, without pay. Compounding her difficulties, moreover, Hunt had trouble acclimatizing and suffered severe headaches and shortness of breath during most of her stay at base camp. After Nawang collapsed trying to walk down the valley Tuesday morning and was brought back up to base camp, he was not put back on oxygen, even though his condition continued to deteriorate, in part because he stubbornly kept insisting that he wasn't sick. At 7 o'clock that evening, Dr. Litch arrived after running up from Faraceh and suggested rather emphatically that Hunt immediately start Nawang on oxygen at maximal flow and then call for a helicopter. By this time, Nawang was slipping in and out of consciousness and was having extreme difficulty breathing. A helicopter evacuation was requested for Wednesday morning, April 24th, but clouds and snow squalls made a flight impossible, so Nawang was loaded into a basket and, under Hunt's care, carried down the glacier to Faraday on the backs of Sherpas. That afternoon, Hall's furrowed brow betrayed his concern. "Nawang is in a bad way," he said. "He has one of the worst cases of pulmonary edema I've ever seen. They should have flown him out yesterday when they had a chance. If it had been one of Scout's clients who was this sick, instead of a Sherpa, I don't think he would have been treated so haphazardly. By the time they get Nawang down to Faraday, it may be too late to save him." When the sick Sherpa arrived at the HRA clinic on Wednesday evening after a 12-hour journey from base camp to Faraday, his condition continued to worsen, despite the fact that he was now at 14,000 feet, an elevation not substantially higher than the village where he'd spent most of his life, compelling Hunt to put him inside the pressurized Gamow bag against his wishes. Unable to grasp the benefits of the inflatable chamber and terrified of it, Nawang asked that a Buddhist Lama be summoned, and before consenting to being zipped into its claustrophobic interior, he requested that prayer books be placed in the bag with him. For the Gamow bag to function properly, an attendant has to continuously inject fresh air into the chamber with a foot pump. By Wednesday night, Hunt was exhausted from caring for Nawang virtually non-stop for the previous 48 hours, so she turned over responsibility for pumping the chamber to several of Nawang's Sherpa friends. While she was dozing, one of these Sherpas noticed through the bag's plastic window that Nawang was frothing at the mouth and had apparently stopped breathing. Awakened with this news, Hunt immediately tore open the bag, commenced cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and summoned Dr. Larry Silver, one of the volunteers working at the HRA clinic. After Silver inserted a tube down Nawang's trachea and began forcing air into his lungs with a rubber ambu-bag, a manual pump, Nawang began breathing again, but only after a period of at least 4 or 5 minutes when no oxygen was reaching his brain. 2 days later, on Friday, April 26th, the weather finally improved enough to permit a helicopter evacuation, and Nawang was flown to a hospital in Kathmandu. But doctors there announced that he'd suffered grave damage to his brain. Nawang was now little more than a vegetable. Over the weeks that followed, he languished in the hospital, staring blankly at the ceiling, arms curled tightly at his sides, muscles atrophying, his weight dropping below 80 pounds. By mid-June, he would be dead, leaving behind a wife and 4 daughters in Rawaling. Oddly, most climbers on Everest knew less about Nawang's plight than tens of thousands of people who were nowhere near the mountain. The information warp was due to the Internet, and to those of us at base camp, it was nothing less than surreal. A teammate might call home on a satellite phone, for instance, and learn what the South Africans were doing at Camp 2 from a spouse in New Zealand or Michigan who'd been surfing the World Wide Web. At least 5 Internet sites were posting dispatches from correspondents at Everest Base Camp. Note: despite considerable hoopla about direct interactive links between the slopes of Mount Everest and the World Wide Web, technological limitations prevented direct hookups from Base Camp to the Internet. Instead, correspondents filed their reports by voice or fax via satellite phone, and those reports were typed into computers for dissemination on the web by editors in New York, Boston, and Seattle. Email was received in Kathmandu, printed out, and the hard copy was transported by yak to base camp. Likewise, all photos that ran on the web had first been sent by yak and then air courier to New York for transmission. Internet chat sessions were done via satellite phone and a typist in New York. End of note. The South African team maintained a website, as did Mal Duff's International Commercial Expedition. Nova, the PBS television show, produced an elaborate and very informative website featuring daily updates from Lisel Clark and the eminent Everest historian Audrey Salkeld, who were members of the McGillivray Freeman IMAX expedition. Headed by the award-winning filmmaker and expert climber David Brashears, who'd guided Dick Bass up Everest in 1985,
The IMAX team was shooting a $5.5 million giant screen movie about climbing the mountain. Scott Fisher's expedition had no less than two correspondents filing online dispatches for a pair of competing websites. Jane Bromet, who phoned in daily reports for Outside Online, was one of the correspondents on Fisher's team, but she wasn't a client and didn't have permission to climb higher than base camp. Note: several magazines and newspapers have erroneously reported that I was a correspondent for Outside Online. The confusion stemmed from the fact that Jane Bromet interviewed me at base camp and posted a transcript of the interview on the Outside Online website. I was not, however, affiliated with Outside Online in any capacity. I had gone to Everest on assignment for Outside Magazine, an independent entity based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that works in loose partnership with Outside Online, based in the Seattle area, to publish a version of the magazine on the Internet. But Outside Magazine and Outside Online are autonomous to such a degree that I didn't even know Outside Online had sent a correspondent to Everest until I arrived at base camp. End of note. The other Internet correspondent on Fisher's expedition, however, was a client who intended to go all the way to the summit and file daily dispatches for NBC Interactive Media en route. Her name was Sandy Hill Pittman, and nobody on the mountain cut a higher profile or generated as much gossip. Pittman, a millionaire socialite-cum-climber, was back for her third attempt on Everest. This year she was more determined than ever to reach the top and thereby complete her much-publicized crusade to climb the seven summits. In 1993, Pittman joined a guided expedition attempting the South Col and Southeast Ridge route, and she caused a minor stir by showing up at base camp with her 9-year-old son, Beau, along with a nanny to look after him. Pittman experienced a number of problems, however, and reached only 24,000 feet before turning around. She was back on Everest in 1994 after raising more than $250,000 from corporate sponsors to secure the talents of four of the finest alpinists in North America. Brashears, who was under contract to film the expedition for NBC Television, Steve Swenson, Barry Blanchard, and Alex Lowe. Lowe, arguably the world's preeminent all-around climber, was hired to be Sandy's personal guide, a job for which he was paid a substantial sum. In advance of Pittman, the four men strung ropes partway up the Kangshung face, an extremely difficult and hazardous wall on the Tibetan side of the mountain. With a great deal of assistance from Low, Pittman ascended the fixed ropes to 22,000 feet, but once again she was forced to surrender her attempt before the summit. This time the problem was dangerously unstable snow conditions that forced the whole team to abandon the mountain. Until I bumped into her at Gorak Shep during the trek to base camp, I'd never met Pittman face to face, although I'd been hearing about her for years. In 1992, Men's Journal assigned me to write an article about riding a Harley-Davidson motorcycle from New York to San Francisco in the company of Jan Venner, the legendary, exceedingly rich publisher of Rolling Stone, Men's Journal, and Us, and several of his wealthy friends, including Rocky Hill, Pittman's brother, and her husband, Bob Pittman, the co-founder of MTV. The ear-splitting, chrome-encrusted hog that Jan loaned me was a thrilling ride, and my high-rolling companions were friendly enough. But I had precious little in common with any of them, and there was no forgetting that I had been brought along as Jan's hired help. Over dinner, Bob and Jan and Rocky compared the various aircraft they owned. Jan recommended a Gulfstream IV the next time I was in the market for a personal jet, discussed their country estates, and talked about Sandy, who happened to be climbing Mount McKinley at the time. "Hey," Bob suggested when he learned that I, too, was a climber, "you and Sandy ought to get together and go climb a mountain." Now, 4 years later, we were. At 5'11", Sandy Pittman stood 2 inches taller than me. Her tomboyishly short hair looked expertly coiffed, even here at 17,000 feet. Ebullient and erect, she'd grown up in Northern California, where her father had introduced her to camping, hiking, and skiing as a young girl. Delighting in the freedoms and pleasures of the hills, she continued to dabble in outdoor pursuits through her college years and beyond,
although the frequency of her visits to the mountains diminished sharply after she moved to New York in the mid-1970s in the aftermath of a failed first marriage. In Manhattan, Pittman worked variously as a buyer at Bonwit Teller, a merchandising editor at Mademoiselle, and a beauty editor at a magazine called Brides. Then in 1979, married Bob Pittman. An indefatigable seeker of public attention, Sandy made her name and picture regular fare in New York society columns. She hobnobbed with Blaine Trump, Tom and Meredith Brokaw, Isaac Mizrahi, Martha Stewart. In order to commute more efficiently between their opulent Connecticut manor and an art-filled apartment on Central Park West staffed with uniformed servants, she and her husband bought a helicopter and learned to fly it. In 1990, Sandy and Bob Pittman were featured on the cover of New York Magazine as the couple of the minute. Soon thereafter, Sandy began her expensive, widely trumpeted campaign to become the first American woman to climb the seven summits. The last, Everest, proved elusive, however, and in March 1994, Pittman lost the race to a 47-year-old Alaskan mountaineer and midwife named Dolly Lefevre. She continued her dogged pursuit of Everest just the same. As Beck Weathers observed one night at base camp, "When Sandy goes to climb a mountain, she doesn't do it exactly like you and me." In 1993, Beck had been in Antarctica making a guided ascent of Vinson Massif at the same time Pittman was climbing the mountain with a different guided group, and he recalled with a chuckle that she brought this humongous duffel bag full of gourmet food that took about four people to even lift. She also brought a portable television and video player so she could watch movies in her tent. I mean, hey, you've got to hand it to Sandy. There aren't too many people who climb mountains in that kind of high style. Beck reported that Pittman had generously shared the swag she'd brought with the other climbers, and that she was pleasant and interesting to be around. For her assault on Everest in 1996, Pittman once again assembled the sort of kit not commonly seen in climbers' encampments. The day before departing for Nepal, in one of her first web postings for NBC Interactive Media, she gushed, "All my personal stuff is packed. It looks like I'll have as much computer and electronic equipment as I will have climbing gear. Two IBM laptops, a video camera, three 35mm cameras, one Kodak digital camera, two tape recorders, a CD-ROM player, a printer, and enough, I hope, solar panels and batteries to power the whole project. I wouldn't dream of leaving town without an ample supply of Dean and DeLuca's Near East blend and my espresso maker. Since we'll be on Everest on Easter, I brought four wrapped chocolate eggs. An Easter egg hunt at 18,000 feet? We'll see." That night, the society columnist Billy Norwich hosted a farewell party for Pittman at Nell's in downtown Manhattan. The guest list included Bianca Jagger and Calvin Klein. Fond of costumes, Sandy appeared wearing a high-altitude climbing suit over her evening dress, complemented by mountaineering boots, crampons, ice axe, and a bandolier of carabiners. Upon arrival in the Himalaya, Pittman appeared to adhere as closely as possible to the proprieties of high society. During the trek to base camp, a young Sherpa named Pemba rolled up her sleeping bag every morning and packed her rucksack for her. When she reached the foot of Everest with the rest of Fisher's group in early April, her pile of luggage included stacks of press clippings about herself to hand out to the other denizens of base camp. Within a few days, Sherpa runners began to arrive on a regular basis with packages for Pittman, shipped to base camp via DHL Worldwide Express. They included the latest issues of Vogue, Vanity Fair, People, Allure. The Sherpas were fascinated by the lingerie ads and thought the perfume scent strips were a hoot. Scott Fisher's team was a congenial and cohesive group. Most of Pittman's teammates took her idiosyncrasies in stride and seemed to have little trouble accepting her into their midst. Sandy could be exhausting to be around because she needed to be the center of attention and was always yapping away about herself, remembers Jane Bromet. But she wasn't a negative person. She didn't bring down the mood of the group. She was energetic and upbeat almost every day. Nevertheless, several accomplished alpinists not on her team regarded Pittman as a grandstanding dilettante. Following her unsuccessful 1994 attempt on Everest's Kangshung face, a television commercial for Vaseline Intensive Care, the expedition's primary sponsor, was loudly derided by knowledgeable mountaineers because it advertised Pittman as a world-class climber. But Pittman never overtly made such a claim herself. Indeed, she emphasized in an article for Men's Journal that she wanted Brashears, Lowe, Swenson, and Blanchard to understand that I didn't confuse my avid hobbyist abilities with their world-class skill. Her eminent companions on the 1994 attempt said nothing disparaging about Pittman, at least not in public. After that expedition, in fact, Brashears became a close friend of hers, and Swenson repeatedly defended Pittman against her critics. "Look," Swenson had explained to me at a social gathering in Seattle shortly after they'd both returned from Everest, "maybe Sandy's not a great climber, but on the Kangshung face, she recognized her limitations. Yes, it's true that Alex and Barry and David and I did all the leading and fixed all the ropes, but she contributed to the effort in her own way by having a positive attitude, by raising money, and by dealing with the media." Pittman did not lack for detractors, however. A great many people were offended by her ostentatious displays of wealth and by the shameless way she chased the limelight. As Joanne Kaufman reported in the Wall Street Journal, "Ms. Pittman was known in certain elevated circles more as a social climber than mountain climber. She and Mr. Pittman were habitués of all the correct soirees and benefits and staples of all the right gossip columns. Many coattails were wrinkled by Sandy Pittman latching onto them," says a former business associate of Mr. Pittman who insisted on anonymity. "She's interested in publicity. If she had to do it anonymously, I don't think she'd be climbing mountains." Fairly or unfairly, to her derogators, Pittman epitomized all that was reprehensible about Dick Bass's popularization of the Seven Summits and the ensuing debasement of the world's highest mountain. But insulated by her money, a staff of paid attendants, and unwavering self-absorption, Pittman was heedless of the resentment and scorn she inspired in others. She remained as oblivious as Jane Austen's Emma. Chapter 9. Camp 2. April 28, 1996. 21,300 feet. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. We look for the sermon in the suicide, for the social or moral lesson in the murder of five. We interpret what we see, select the most workable of the multiple choices. We live entirely, especially if we are writers, by the imposition of a narrative line upon disparate images, by the ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria which is our actual experience. Joan Didion, The White Album. I was already awake at 4 a.m. when the alarm on my wristwatch began to beep. I'd been awake most of the night, struggling for breath in the meager air. And now it was time to commence the dreaded ritual of emerging from the warmth of my goose-down cocoon into the withering cold of 21,300 feet. 2 days earlier, on Friday, April 26th, we'd humped all the way from base camp to Camp 2 in one long day to begin our third and final acclimatization sortie in preparation for the summit push. This morning, according to Rob's grand plan, we would climb from Camp 2 to Camp 3 and spend a night at 24,000 feet. Rob had told us to be ready to leave at 4:45 sharp, 45 minutes hence, which allowed barely enough time to dress, force down a candy bar and some tea, and strap on my crampons. Shining my headlamp on a dime store thermometer clipped to the parka I'd been using as a pillow, I saw that the temperature inside the cramped two-person tent was 7 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. "Doug," I yelled at the lump burrowed in the sleeping bag beside me, "time to get rolling, Slick. You awake over there?" "Awake?" he rasped in a weary voice. "What makes you think I ever went to sleep? I feel like shit. I think something's wrong with my throat. Man, I'm getting too old for this stuff." During the night, our fetid exhalations had condensed on the tent fabric to form a fragile interior sheath of hoarfrost. As I sat up and began rooting around in the dark for my clothing, it was impossible not to brush against the low nylon walls, and every time I did so, it instigated a blizzard inside the tent, covering everything with ice crystals. Shivering hard, I zipped my body into three layers of fuzzy polypropylene pile underwear and an outer shell of windproof nylon, then pulled my clunky plastic boots on. Yanking the laces tight made me wince in pain. For the past 2 weeks, the condition of my cracked, bleeding